This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And now, another episode in what seems to be our never-ending series about drug prices. And in this case, price fixing. Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. She is the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How We Can Take It Back, MD from Harvard. I mean, classic overachiever is what you are, Elizabeth. And you've written a piece for the New York Times about these price increases, and you call it a drug cartel. That term is usually used for illegal drugs. Why do you apply it to the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, what we've seen over time is that some of these price increases have to do with, if not explicit, implicit coordination between different drug makers and device makers, I should say. It's not just in the drug world. When they're raising prices to do it kind of in coordination. So, you know, the logic of a market is that, wow, there are all these competitors and they're going to come in and it's going to be a race to the bottom and we'll get really cheap generic drugs,
right,
which we see once in a while. But more often what we've seen in the last few years is that they'll raise prices in coordination. And, you know, the worry initially when I saw this in 2014 was like, is this just kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod where, okay, I'll raise my price literally by 1,000%. And my competitor, instead of trying to undercut me, will also raise the price by 1,000%. And as long as we're both getting a price that's 1,000% more, whose interest is it to start a price war? Essentially no one. So that's what we've seen more and more. And what's coming out now in some investigations and suits by state's attorneys general is that there is actually price fixing going on, that they are meeting over golf on the golf course or over girls' night out dinners to say, let's do. When I initially saw this in 2014, I thought it was kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod. What the attorneys generals have been finding is there is active coordination and collaboration, which is what a cartel does.
Well, this is classic collusion. It's price fixing. I thought that's been illegal for years, hasn't it?
Well, you know, collusion is a charged word at the moment, but
case, it seems to actually apply.
Yes. No, I think that's what we're seeing now. And it's going to be very hard to tell in any given case. Is collusion active collusion or is it passive collusion? And what I hear from attorneys is that active collusion is against the law, but maybe more insidious and more problematic is this kind of passive collusion, because when everyone's making a whole lot of money, they can kind of, you know, in whose interest is it to cut prices? No
right.
one's.
And that's the other frustrating thing. This is happening with generic drugs where the research and production costs, development costs, have already been paid off. And so now everybody knows the formula. They're being made for a few cents a pill and being sometimes sold for $100 a pill. And there's no way around it because they just all sit back and say, why ruin the gravy train, huh?
Well, that's essentially it. And, you know, we always used to say, well, generics are what's great about American pharmaceuticals because they're low price and that's how we keep drug costs under control. And, you know, when you think about it, why are generics cheaper? They're not inherently cheaper. It's just because that's the way the market worked. And someone had the idea that, well, what rule of the universe says the generics have to be cheap? And what we see in research now is, okay, if there are 10 generics, maybe that will introduce competition. But even there, not necessarily. And if there's only one or two or three, forget it. They're all just going to charge more.
So how does Europe get away with it? Is this why they don't mind that Europe regulates drug prices, because they know they can make it all back on the backs of sick Americans?
Basically, yes. You know, Europe has never been into generics the way the U.S. has because they do regulate drug prices. So if you regulate drug prices and say the brand can't be astronomical, you don't need those cut price generics as much. But since we let the brands charge whatever they want, generics were our solution. But that solution no longer works. remember, I 4 or 5 years ago, you'd hear about these $5 prescriptions at Target or Walmart, which still exist. So in some cases, generics drop prices dramatically. But that's not what we see anymore. A generic will come in and go, wow, it's a good deal. It's a generic. It's cheaper. And you look at the price and, you know, the list price is $5,000 and the generic is, you know, $4,990. So generics, yeah, they may be a tiny bit cheaper, but they don't solve the pricing problem in a world of astronomically priced drugs.
Well, I'm tired of covering the story and seeing nothing done. And I think it's time for President Trump to make good on his campaign promise. He said he was going to get a handle on this. Do you have any indication that the White House is going to step in and read the riot act to these guys?
Well, I think, you know, politicians on both sides of the aisle are pretty fed up with this. But I have to say, you know, one of the Trump administration's policy interventions has been, we're going to speed generics to market. We're going to make that faster. Well, hey, if generics are only marginally cheaper, that doesn't really solve much. So, you know, personally, to me, it's hard to think about how we're going to get around price setting if this generic strategy doesn't work. But we do see, I believe you saw the article in the Washington Post a couple of days ago about how states' attorneys generals are taking on the generic drug industry. They're going to start charging them, I believe, for being a cartel, for collusion. That may, some people will probably get big fines. A couple may even get some prison time. Will that put enough fear in the industry to make others behave better? I don't know. I'm a little skeptical because shaming hasn't seemed to work well.
No, shaming doesn't work.
In the world of healthcare pricing.
At some point, it seems to me somebody with a lot of courage and who doesn't mind the consequences of the crazy things he says, even though they come from the Oval Office, should take a stand on this and bust some heads. That's what I say.
Well, that would be nice. I mean, Congress could do something, too. I mean, you know, there are a lot of threats on both sides of the aisle. We're going to allow importation of drugs. That actually would bring prices down really quickly. They could say we're going to let Medicare negotiate drug prices. That would help. There have been bipartisan bills on both of those proposals. Maybe it's time for Congress to take some action, too, because they have power on this front as well.
So it sounds like there are a lot of options here. All we need is somebody with the courage to adopt them.
Well, that's true. But I think whoever brings down drug prices in this country, that will be a big vote getter. So part of it is, yes, you need someone who's politically brave. But I think we're seeing this in the states. We're seeing a lot of state reps take on this drug pricing issue. And you know what? It's a good vote getter. So if I were a politician, I would be running on this. And I'm pretty sure I would win, so I'm hoping others will make that same calculation.
When are you announcing?
I have a job to do down here.
That's right. Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, Editor-in-Chief at Kaiser Health News. Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Just about everyone you see walking down the street has those earbuds in their ear. We assume that they're slowly going deaf. But perhaps, music has health benefits that we have failed to properly appreciate. Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. There is considerable literature on how music can improve your health, correct?
Yeah, Dave, I love this topic because it's something that we all can kind of relate to. I think everybody, when they listen to music, experiences some sort of an emotion. And we can all think of songs that have elicited emotion in us. In fact, Billy Joel, well-known American musician, once said, "I think music in itself is healing. It's an explosive expression of humanity. It's something we are all touched by, no matter what culture we're from. Everyone loves music." And that's a super true statement, that we really can be affected by music. And if it affects our emotions, the real question is, well, can it also affect our health? And as you said, there's been a lot of research. The real question is can music affect our physiology? So not can it just affect our emotions and make us feel better about things, but and affect our mood, but can it affect our actual physiology? And there's actually studies that have demonstrated that, in fact, it can.
I've seen it used to reduce pain. I was covering the whole idea of bone marrow transplants back when it was novel. And when they insert that needle, it's fairly painful. And so in addition to some of the painkillers, they would play soothing music.
And it's funny, actually, again, another well-known musician, Bob Marley, once sang, one good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain. And actually, the studies say that this is probably true. There have been numerous studies that have demonstrated that music can reduce both pain and anxiety for patients who have undergone surgery. So, for example, there was a meta-analysis that looked at 72 different randomized controlled trials that involved over 7,000 patients who received a surgery, some sort of surgical procedure. And the researchers in that meta-analysis ultimately found that those who were played music after the procedure actually reported feeling less pain and anxiety than those who didn't listen to music. And so they were less likely to require as much pain medication.
I'm wondering if there's something in, for example, they say that Mozart can help you think in an orderly fashion. But is it the type of music itself, or could it be the memories that playing the music elicits based on, you know, when you first heard that song?
Yeah, that's another good point. And it actually is probably a little bit of both. The thing is that we have a deep connection to music because it's actually hardwired into our brains and into our bodies. Another study that was done in Canada at McGill University found that music increases the amount of dopamine that's produced in our brain. And dopamine itself is a mood-enhancing chemical that, in fact, is the way that many antidepressants work. They actually work by elevating brain levels of dopamine. It's possible that music could be used in the treatment of depression.
And this is based on data. So I assume they played certain musical selections and they monitored heart rate and stuff like that and actually saw an effect.
In the study where they were trying to measure dopamine activity in the brain, they were using a PET scan, and they found that there were increased levels of dopamine in the
and
brain.
And the PET scan is what?
Positron emission tomography, and that looks at activity in the brain.
Shows which parts of the brain are lighting up.
Yeah, it actually looks at glucose metabolism, and they can actually label the glucose in different ways so that they can look to see what's happening in the brain at the time they're testing it. And in addition, they also use a test called a functional MRI or an fMRI at the same time to see what was happening in the brain.
And it showed that what? I mean, is this anything that you can actually control? Again, can you pick a certain musical selection based on your symptoms?
Well, we don't really completely understand this yet, but there was actually a study that was published in Lancet Psychiatry. Now, remember, Lancet, we've talked about it before, is actually one of the leading medical journals in the world. And then they have different branches that are subspecialty branches. And in this case, there's Lancet Psychiatry. And there was a paper published earlier this year that listening to hip-hop music, particularly from one artist, Kendrick Lamar, actually helped individuals to better understand their mental health disorders. So it involved researchers working with patients and then listening to music that addressed things like depression and alcoholism and drug use and so forth. And so it was the combination of listening to the music, working with the patient, and then working with the physician researcher that helped them to get a better understanding of what their issues were. You know, other more complicated areas of medicine where it's thought that music could play a role is helping people recover from brain injury or treating seizures. And there was actually a study published in 2008 in Finland that found that stroke patients who listened to music for around 2 hours a day actually had better verbal memory and attention span and a more positive mood than those who listened to an audiobook or nothing at all. So we're trying to understand how music exerts its health benefit, but what is clear from all the studies that have been published is that music can play a really important role in helping us with both learning and reducing pain and recovering from certain illnesses, or helping us slow down the progress of certain illnesses. Music is actually very, very therapeutic. Science is interested in seeing how to make it work, and I think we're going to see a lot more of it as we move forward.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
There you go. So Kendrick Lamar, good for your mental health. A federal judge in Texas has ruled that the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, is invalid, as in unconstitutional. President Trump has praised the ruling. Not all Republicans are sure they really wanted to see this, but let's find out what it means from Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Julie Rovner. Julie, first of all, for people who are covered now by Obamacare, they are safe for now or not?
They are safe for now. The Trump administration said Friday night, even while the president was praising the ruling, the people who run the program say that it will continue to run pending resolution of this court case, which could take a while.
I haven't read all 55 pages yet, but let me see if I understand the concept here. Congress already took away the tax penalty for not buying insurance, which basically meant you were no longer forced to buy insurance. In other words, the mandate was killed. And the judge said, as a result of that, since the mandate is so crucial to covering everybody, the whole thing is now invalid.
Well, yes, although that's the reason he said that taking away the tax penalty made it invalid is because in 2012, when the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality, Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion, said that the whole law was a valid exercise of Congress's taxing power. So the judge said that, well, without the tax, then the whole thing has to fall. This judge is pretty much out on a limb here. Even a lot of Republican, health experts and those who have challenged the law under other reasons said that they're not quite buying this argument.
But, I mean, the whole idea of covering everybody, including people who are already sick with pre-existing conditions, falls apart unless everybody's required to have insurance, doesn't it?
Well, that's what we thought until last year when Congress, spawning this case, got rid of the mandate. And everybody was afraid that insurers wouldn't want to offer coverage and that they would dramatically raise their premiums. And what turned out to be the case, first of all, the tax penalty wasn't very big. What seems to be attracting people to buy individual insurance are the subsidies, the help that the government is giving for people to offset their costs, to basically make it affordable. And what we're seeing this year is that, yes, enrollment is down. It's not finished. There's still several states where you can still enroll through January, but it's not down that much. And in fact, premiums this year are flat or lower in a lot of places. So everybody's predictions about what would happen if the mandate went away turned out to be wrong, which is kind of ironic in this case because the judge was saying, well, you know, it's essential. Therefore, the whole thing falls. Well, we've discovered in the process of this last 6 weeks of open enrollment that it's not necessarily essential.
Well, then, but that would be pretty good news then on a number of fronts. Be good news for Donald Trump because he has been proposing this idea of a beautiful first-class health care plan that doesn't require everyone to buy insurance, which Democrats have dismissed as impossible. But you're saying we're learning it might be possible.
That's what we have now. We have a system that doesn't require everybody to buy insurance, but it makes it affordable for people with mm-hmm. moderate incomes. Now, there's still a lot of problems, some of which we've talked about, including people who make just a little bit too much to get that help. Those people are getting hammered. Their premiums really are skyrocketing, and they're just getting completely unaffordable, and something obviously needs to be done to help that subset. These are the people who buy their own insurance, so they don't have job insurance from their jobs, but they make too much, more than 400% of poverty, to get government help with their premiums and other costs.
What income level is that?
It's about $100,000 for a family of four. I think it's about $65,000 for an individual. It changes mm-hmm. every year.
So for a family of four making over $100,000, they're the ones who are really getting hammered now.
Oh, yeah. It's mostly. And of course, if you're older, you can be charged more. So, you know, most of the stories, including the ones that I wrote, are about people in their, you know, in their 50s and early 60s who aren't old enough for Medicare. But you can charge older people more. So they're just in that, you know, sort of terrible space where they're being charged more because they're older and they're not getting help from the government. And those premiums, I mean, it's not unusual to hear about, you know, premiums that are $30,000 a year. I mean, that are more than people's mortgages. So there are definitely problems, but getting rid of the entire law might be a little bit of an overkill way to fix it.
Okay, but I'm trying to figure this out now. So now $30,000, that's unaffordable. I mean, people are – that's going to give you a heart attack right there.
Right, if you're making $70,000. Right, exactly.
But here's what I don't understand. If there is no requirement for everyone to have health care, and if insurance is so prohibitively expensive, why would anybody buy it? Why not just wait until you're sick and then buy it instead of having to carry it
because on the individual market, you can't buy it except during open enrollment. So you can't wait until you're sick and then buy it.
Oh, I
see. That is still in force, although I suppose that would go away if the Affordable Care Act went away. But that's why we have this open enrollment. You get to decide. You get 6 weeks a year to decide if you want to take that risk of not having insurance.
OK, so are the number of people who are not covered by health insurance, is that going up now?
It is a little bit. Interestingly, it's going up among kids. There's a whole lot of reasons that you know, analysts are looking at. Some of it is this sort of change to immigration status of whether using government programs and even getting government assistance to buy, you know, drugs under Medicare Part D might count against you if you're trying to get a green card. Mm-hmm. There's been less outreach. There's, you know, the public is always way behind on what it understands about what Washington has done.
Right. Well, what I'm trying to figure out, Julie, is if there are more people going uncovered, and some of these are poor people who haven't got money, who pays for their health care? Hospitals still have to treat them, right?
That's right.
So who pays for that?
The hospitals do, taxpayers do through other ways. Hospitals cost shift to the extent they can to other people with insurance. I mean, basically society pays for that.
So that is going to show up in terms of higher premiums for the rest of us? Or, well, it's not going to be higher taxes because the president is not going to raise taxes. So the only place they'd get it is higher premiums, or else the doctors just work for free. I just don't understand how that pencils out.
Basically, there are all kinds of programs to help, particularly hospitals with what they call uncompensated care. Some of it becomes charity care. Some of it comes from state and local governments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can raise taxes. But some of it also comes in higher premiums.
Oh, so state taxes might be raised then.
Yes, to the extent that premiums can be raised, because one of the other things the Affordable Care Act did was it put limits on premiums.
Okay, so if this ruling Obamacare unconstitutional is upheld, what happens?
Basically, the whole healthcare system gets thrown into chaos because we always talk about the individual market and the mandate and, you know, kids under 26 staying on their parents' health plan and some of the patient protections. That was Title I of a 10-title bill. This law rewrote almost everything that the federal government does in terms of healthcare. And if the entire law were to go away, basically the federal government would lose all its authority to regulate most of what it regulates in healthcare. It would be a giant mess.
Well, we go back to the free market then, where competition will force prices down, 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 so it's affordable for everybody.
Yeah, but then you'd have 75 million people on Medicare and Medicaid who'd be unable to get care.
But the hospitals would still have to take care of them.
You only have to stabilize emergencies. You don't have to. That's a myth. But hospitals don't have to take care of sick people. They have to stabilize people who show up with life-threatening emergencies or in women in active labor. That's the only federal requirement.
But if you get cancer, they don't have to give you chemotherapy if you can't afford it.
Nope.
I see. All right, Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News. Thank you.
Sure.
Time for your Daily Dose of Kindness is brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. Each year, the same anonymous, wealthy businessman becomes a Secret Santa. He traverses the U.S. and sweetens the holidays for strangers. But this year, he did something different. He recruited some help where many would least expect it. Here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
How are you doing today? You ready for Christmas?
A lot of people ignore the homeless. But folks rushing past Moses Elder may regret their haste.
Yeah, brilliant.
Because this week, all people had to do was pay him some attention.
Ladies!
And he would pay them back in Benjamins.
So there's $100 for you?
You can imagine the shock.
$100 for you.
Thank you.
Oh, that's what Christmas is all about.
Moses's mission was financed by Secret Santa.
Merry Christmas to you, sweetie.
The same anonymous, wealthy businessman who every year goes around the country handing out $100 bills to random strangers.
What to do with this?
But this holiday season, in addition to his normal giving, he came here to Phoenix.
Morning.
Good morning.
And recruited this most unlikely homeless elf.
I want to enlist you to help me. Can we do that?
Yes.
All right.
Oh,
so here's what we're going to do.
He gave Moses about $3,000 with the instruction to give it away to whoever he saw fit.
I think this will be a joyful experience for him. You know, it's a myth that, you know, the homeless just take. From my experience, the people with the least give the most of what they have.
We saw that, too.
Hey, come here for a minute. Come here.
Danny McCoy put change in the cup, even though he has seven kids, and until this moment,
here's $100 for you, sir, for showing your kind heart.
Had no idea how he was going to buy Christmas presents.
Eternally grateful for
for what he did.
You got looking for a job?
And that's the kind of relief Moses brought to so many here.
You had that for me.
Most of those he blessed were strangers who just happened by.
God bless you.
But not all.
We love you. Don't you ever forget that.
He gave this guy from church $400. He gave this homeless mother of five $500.
And remember, people appreciate you with your caring, giving heart that you take care of your kids the way you do.
Thank you.
Okay?
Of course, in the end, Secret Santa also gave Moses some money to keep for himself.
This here is a new beginning for me.
But he says that reward pales to the joy he received from helping others.
Today we changed a lot of people's lives, but I believe my life was changed the most. God bless us both.
He says even when you're homeless, it feels so much better to give than receive.
Y'all don't know, I'm happier than y'all.
You know, kindness is a bridge between all people. And so if you're ever down and you want to lift yourself up, go do something kind for somebody.
Maybe that'll help you.
It'll make you feel like way more than $100.
There you go. Thank you. That's okay.
Steve Hartman.
That's okay.
On the road in Phoenix.
Yes, that's okay.
I guess money can buy happiness when you give it away. Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Well, your prediction was really wrong this time. I can't really come up with any explanation for it.
Other than weird stuff happens in sporting
weird
events.
Weird stuff happens.
And perhaps asking for a prediction beforehand is setting someone up for failure.
Maybe.
Was this really strange, though? Because they've been known for over-penalizing themselves before. I mean, this was just a repeat of what we see. It was so frustrating.
Yes. That was different, though. You had three different penalties that were called at really crucial moments, one of which I completely think is a joke. The pass interference one? Yes, on Shaquille Griffin. Yeah. I didn't see, and that's probably the least damaging of the three calls. 148 yards, though. That's the most they've ever lost in franchise history, and they played football for a while. I mean, they played football for 43 years.
I think you noted in your write-up of the game, the last time they set a franchise record for yards lost to penalties was 1979?
Yes, that's correct. It's
what?
The most yards that they've lost due to penalties in a game since 1979. So they stunk.
I raised concerns about this game last Friday. You heard me. I was worried they were going to be overconfident. You don't think that was it, though, huh?
I don't think it was overconfidence. The rain didn't help. They certainly shot
Rains
themselves
on both
in the
teams,
foot.
Danny.
It does.
Rain doesn't cause you to hold either. Every time they ran the ball and made progress, holding penalty.
Yes.
I mean, I could call.
Well,
I could
but what I keep hearing
before.
Is you could call holding on every play if you wanted to.
That's correct as well.
Mm.
So that makes you wonder why holding was called on a running play that would have set them up for the game-winning field goal.
Yeah.
Hmm. Kind of like it happened against the L.A. Rams earlier this season. It's unusual. And look. They showed they were very capable of losing that game on their own, giving up a kickoff return for a touchdown, missing an extra point.
By the way, who wasn't number 11 supposed to tackle that guy as he ran past?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. You should tackle him, but no, that didn't happen.
Okay.
Did not get tackled.
Was there an explanation for that? Because he seemed to be standing there watching him run past.
The kicker?
Yeah.
The explanation is that he's played football for darn near 20 years professionally, and he has one tackle so far, and he's not about to start now.
I see.
Yeah. The guy made an athletic move. He had already slipped and fallen. He's the kicker.
Okay.
We have a pretty low bar for what we expect. Can
he just like lay down in front of the guy?
That would have been more effective.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He just kind of coasted by.
And you think his teammates are okay with that? Because if that was my teammate, I don't know how I'd react to that. I think, man,
well,
you couldn't have done anything.
It's just a game.
Because he really, yeah. You think I would? I don't think. I'm highly competitive.
I don't think it was because he was lazy. I think it was because he's pretty, that's not a skill set he has to be able to adjust to a guy. He was forcing him out of bounds, and when the guy cut inside, Janikowski wasn't going to get outside. Mm. Like, that's, do I think his teammates are pleased with him? No, I think his teammates think he's a kicker. And therefore only a part of a football player, like a portion.
Okay.
Like when it comes to
really?
Yes. Yeah, kickers forever. They have a very specialized skill set.
So really, no kicker would have tried to tackle him?
Well, yeah, he tried to tackle him.
Yeah.
He just didn't do it very well at all. He was trying to force him to the out-of-bounds marker when he cut back inside. He has a substantial amount of inertia given his girth, so he wasn't able to push it backward. But yeah, that was pretty shameful.
It just felt like a complete breakdown of the team's momentum.
Yeah. I think that's pretty accurate, Colleen.
Yeah.
It absolutely was.
I mean,
was.
I'm trying to find blame
yeah.
and put it on anyone like the kicker, but really it was just a breakdown of the entire team.
If I was going to blame, like, who's most responsible for that, the defense bears it for the first half, but then they played a pretty good second half. The offense, they weren't terrible. Chris Carson rushed for 120 yards. Russell didn't get picked off. He didn't turn it over.
Yeah, the stats look
pretty good. Carroll's got some in there because of his general approach, which is, hey, usually when we win the turnover battle and we hang in there and have a close game, we're going to win those. And in this case, didn't account for all of the penalties that his team suffered and how the officiating gets a chunk of it.
But they're still in the playoffs.
They got to win one more.
They got to win one
of their final two. Their odds went from 98% chance of making the playoffs to 95%.
Oh.
Chance of making the playoffs.
So Kansas City and then the Cardinals.
That's correct. They have to win one of those two to guarantee themselves a berth.
Both at home.
Yes, both at home.
They're going to be angry. Yeah. Coming back
control their destiny?
Yeah, of course they do.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, they got a nice firm grasp of that destiny,
okay.
Dave. Are you holding on?
Apparently not.
Just don't ask Sebastian Janikowski to tackle the destiny.
Okay.
Because then you'll see it going right on by.
Well, that's on me. I didn't realize they weren't supposed to tackle.
Colleen, what would you have said to him if he was on your team? Would you just come over there and go, dude.
Take one for the team. What are you doing? We can put any kicker in there. Sacrifice your body this one time. We're going to the playoffs.
You'd also just missed an extra point, too.
All the more reason.
Thank you, Danny.
All the more reason to scold him.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.
See bye.
Yeah. President Trump caused a stir yesterday when he tweeted that he would review the case of a former Army major charged with murder. Matthew Goldstein publicly admitted to killing a suspected Taliban bomb maker during his 2010 deployment to Afghanistan. The killing, though, was against the rules of engagement. Although I sometimes will pull out this cut from Jack Bauer on the old Series 24.
The people that I deal with, they don't care about your rules. All they care about is a result.
And in this case, the soldier was protecting somebody, protecting an ally, apparently, at least in his mind. But let's go to CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. What were the circumstances, Mike, of the kill? What was Matthew Goldstein's side of the case?
So, Dave, he was responsible for looking for an individual who was a bomb maker that took out two of Marines that he was working with. So two Marines are killed. He takes a patrol into town, finds who he perceives to be the bomb maker, the one responsible for the IED. He brings him in front of Afghan civilian authorities who say they don't have enough evidence to hold him, but they're concerned if they release him back, then he'll come back and get the Afghan civilians. So what he did was they released him back to the civilian society, and then a few days later, him and a few other people went back after him, and based on what the reports are, he summarily executed him and then buried his body, hid for a while, and then brought it back and eventually got rid of him. So he was concerned that he was going to come back and wreak havoc on the civilian population there.
Is that a legitimate reason for doing what he did?
No, not at all. And there's always two sides to the story, and I've got to hear more of his side. But the way he seems to tell it, he seems to be very justified in the fact that what he did was right. I can't, you know, it's difficult for me to see how, from the rules of engagement are, you know, we can't murder people. He should have been brought to justice from the Afghan civilian side, wasn't for whatever reason, was released back, that maybe there wasn't enough evidence there. But Major Goldstein and his team were convinced that he was the bomb maker based on what they found in this guy's home during their search process.
Well, as I read the story, the Goldstein was concerned that one of the tribal members who had pointed the finger at this guy as the bomb maker would himself be endangered if that guy ever got free and went back to the Taliban.
That's right. And not only him, but others, that there were anyone that was involved, anyone that was working with the Americans back then, given what was going on. It was a battle. We had about 15,000 soldiers as well involved in the battle. But this is, you know, one specific part of it that, you know, he's a Green Beret working mostly with the Afghan security forces there at the time, trying to, you know, kind of win hearts and minds at kind of the height of the surge that took place there and the counterinsurgency strategy that was going on. But the story gets out, and that's his problem. He told to the CIA he had to pass a polygraph test, so he had to tell about the story when he did there. And that was the concern there, because they pulled his, they stripped him of his medal. He was given a medal for his actions for this conduct, but that eventually was stripped from him.
Okay. Now, he had admitted to this. He was trying to get a job at the CIA, and they said, well, we're going to give you a lie detector test. Be sure to tell us about any skeletons in your closet, or it's going to go badly for you. And now, of course, he told the truth. Now, this was discussed on Fox and Friends. The president saw this story, and now he has said that he's going to review this. What's your feeling? He's the commander-in-chief, after all, so what's your feeling about that?
Yeah, he's a little bit out far in front of this, and not a good idea on a lot of levels. He is in the chain of command, technically, and this should play out. Let the military justice system figure out what the charges are. Let's have the evidence been presented, and let we go from there. But when the president puts his finger on the scale right now, this early in the process, based on what he saw on a television show, I saw the same clip. That's going to be very one-sided, frankly. There's always two sides to the story. I've got a lot of empathy for this major. He's a West Point graduate. You know, he should have known better if this is what exactly happened with what he's charged with. But what the president did is not going to help the whole process.
What would the rank and file view be of this, especially if the president decides to pardon him?
Well, it'll just open up a Pandora's box with many other individuals who have been charged. There's three or four others that are awaiting a similar trial, some Navy SEALs cases. You've got civilian authorities or civilian groups now trying to take up in defense of some of these. When you deploy the kind of troops that we had in these environments for the past 15 years, you're going to have these kinds of incidences still, as much as you try to train against them. Doesn't seem like we have – it's not a My Lai type massacre. It's not a massacre of 100 or 400 people that we saw in My Lai back in Vietnam. But these kind of one-off situations where individuals take it upon themselves to go outside the rules of engagement.
But some people are going to say, you know, it's war. And things like this happen in war. We can't call it murder when it's war.
Well, I think there's a bright line between murder and not murder. For example, I've said before, at the end of the Gulf War, we could have kept going. We would have murdered a lot of people who were trying to surrender. You can't shoot somebody that's not fighting. You know, if they want to surrender, you've got to go through all those processes. And in this case, what appears to have happened is this person was executed. He's being charged with premeditated murder. He's not being charged with, you know, some accidental manslaughter type thing. He's being charged with thinking this through and really going after this guy.
CBS military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's talk now about the stretch of highway that runs along the site of one of the worst disasters the state's ever seen. Those impacted by the deadly 2014 Oso landslide are trying to get that part of State Route 530 renamed, and Hannah Scott is here with a progress report. Hannah.
Yeah, so Dave, we had been telling you for months about the efforts of volunteers and families and loved ones of the 43 people killed in that 2014 Oso landslide to build a permanent memorial at that slide site. Those efforts are ongoing, and in a separate effort, they are also trying to get that stretch of highway near where the slide happened renamed the Oso Memorial Highway. John Hathaway is one of those leading those efforts. His brother Stephen was killed in the slide.
To be named the Oso Memorial Highway, and it will have, you know, signs up there to state this is what you're coming into, so people will be able to see it. And it's just to identify that area for whoever, you know, is coming through. They're going to see that it's not Highway 530 no more, and it, if you want to call it sacred ground, or if you want to call it, you know, the memorial area. It's just another step to accomplish the goals, you know, we all want to accomplish.
And those goals?
The big thing is, for me and a lot of the family members, is it's everybody's family member, the community, the volunteers, the firefighters that was there, FEMA. It's to give them, this is who it's for, plus the big thing is the 43 people, and to keep their legacy alive with everything that went on. Just something that needs to be there.
For John and others touched by the slide, traveling down that stretch of the highway, which is between Arlington and Darrington, just in front of where the Steelhead Drive neighborhood used to be, can be a very difficult experience. But most endure it, and they travel to the site at least once a year, if not more, to see the 43 trees that were planted there for each of those killed in the slide.
It's hard to even put in words what I'm feeling, but it's a whole new world when you go and you drive through there. I've met people that just heard about it on the news down there, and I'm over by my brother's tree, and they will come over and tapped me on the shoulder and asked me if I lost someone, and I turned around and they're crying. We hugged, never know the person, never knew the person until that second. It has a lot of emotion, and it's going to have a lot of history.
And for John, renaming the highway is important for the legacy of his brother, Stephen.
He was just on a job, and he was installing a satellite dish. And that day he went to work and he didn't come home. It means a lot to me to have his legacy a part of this. You know, when people go and they're going to see about my brother.
And getting the highway renamed is just as important for all of the other families of those lost who I've been speaking to, survivors as well, and the community and everybody else touched by this. But in order to get it done, they do need your help. They want to get this renamed the Oso Memorial Highway, and they need everyone who supports the idea to send letters to the State Transportation Commission. That's the normal process. So that's basically what they're calling for. Mm-hmm. We have the information that you can find on mynorthwest.com. You can fill out the letter, sign it, send it in. Some local lawmakers are also getting involved in that effort, as is the Snohomish County Council. They'll be passing a resolution on Wednesday that will go to the commission. There is also a slight chance that the legislature may take some action on this.
Very good. That sounds like something that's going to get done.
Yeah, and we've seen that. You know, we've seen it for state patrol troopers who've been lost and various other things. So I think that there's a good chance. You can also find out everything about the memorial efforts and how you can help with that at mynorthwest.com.
Very good. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Guy Radio's Hannah Scott.